Hello and welcome to The Big Interview. I'm Ed Stocker. My guest today is an American commercial real estate broker and CEO of the New York Tri-State region of CBRE, the world's largest commercial real estate company. Mary Ann Tai has brokered some of the Big Apple's biggest deals, from bringing Condé Nast to Lower Manhattan to overseeing the New York Times' move to its current location on 8th Avenue. Widely seen as one of the most powerful women in the city, everywhere she looks in the Manhattan skyline, she's reminded of her work. And it's a pleasure to say that I do have Mary Ann Tai right here with me in the studio in New York today. Mary Ann, thank you so much for being here in the studio with me today on a beautiful, sunny and finally warm day here in New York City. Now, I want to come on to your, you know, some of your key projects, as it were, a little later on. But I want to pull back for a second and ask, you know, I think real estate, especially New York City, which may be quite possibly one of the craziest cities in the world to be a real estate broker. How tough do you have to be? I ask because I think it has a slight reputation in New York City as being a very cutthroat industry up there with, say, finance. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, how tough do you think you have to be to get by and survive and strike those deals here in NYC?
So there is an enormous competition in New York, and I don't think about being tough anymore because I think because I don't need to at this point. But I think when I made the transition into this industry, which was in 1984, and I had come out of a very different background. I was an art historian by training. I'd worked in the government, and then I'd worked for ABC Video Enterprises in the cable industry. I worked in very collegial environments. And while one might say that working in politics back in the late 70s, it was a very different environment in politics than it is today. So I was used to something where working collaboratively, sharing information, et cetera, was, you know, at the heart of what I did. And then I moved into an industry where it was keep it to yourself. Strangely enough, though, I think I came in at a time when the business got much more complicated, that information was both more available and opaque, and this is an opaque market. I mean, one of the great strengths of Manhattan in terms of value is its physical constraints, but also its regulatory constraints. Why do people come from all over the world to invest here? Because nobody's throwing up a building tomorrow. Just not happening. So for me, I think that the business began to change just as I entered it. And I think I was lucky to have a set of skills. For example, I was used to working in politics. So that if I was working on a project, I returned to the Trade Center because it's a perfect example, where the land is owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, it occurred to me very early on that I should be talking to the head of the Port Authority. And if you've worked in the White House, if you were the chief operating officer of a federal agency, as I was in my youth, I testified before Congress, it was no big deal for me to network my way to the head of the Port Authority and say, hey, Chris Ward, what do you think about Condé Nast anchoring your building only if you give me the sun, the moon, and the stars, and begin the conversation there as opposed to beginning at a level that wasn't empowered to actually make any of these decisions? So there were a lot of things that happened. The other thing that happened, by the way, is that it became a more corporate business. I mean, at the scale that we're talking about, when you're practicing for larger entities here in New York as a broker, you're really dealing with corporate real estate, the corporate, what we call the C-suite, the CEOs, the presidents and the CFOs. And so, again, the need to be both comfortable in that environment, not to feel intimidated by it, and to understand what their drivers were, which are not the same as real estate. I always joke with real estate people that owners, developers are always telling me what a good real estate deal is, and I'm always telling them I'm actually looking for real estate that works with a company's business plan. It's nice if it can also be a good real estate deal, but it's much more important that it actually dovetail with how they operate their business. So I think as you begin layering in all those factors, you begin moving away from the herd. So I, you know, have not gotten most of my business by cold calling. I've tended to represent people exclusively. In fact, that's all I do for the last more than a decade. And I tend to have long-term relationships. So I think, again, it's a hard business. I wouldn't want to be starting again, but it's a pretty interesting business to practice at the level that I'm able to do it.
I want to pick up on something you said about, you know, your background working at the White House, and we'll go back to that in a second. But you said something quite interesting, that there you were used to, I guess, sharing information. Now, I've read something about you saying that one of the biggest mistakes you feel perhaps in the past was that, you know, in this business of brokerage, you regret at some points sharing information. Maybe you can just expand on what you meant by that.
I think that was the biggest transition shock for me when I moved from my other part of my life into this, because I thought that if we were at the same company, we were on the same team. And I learned very early on, within the first couple of years, that that was not the widespread perception. By the way, I like to think that the business as we operated at CBRE today is different. In fact, I know it is, because we established, many moons ago, groups where all we do is share information. And again, what's so funny is everyone figures we're in the world of the internet. How is there anything that is not available if you know how to search for it? And again, the beauty of our market is, given how complex it is and how huge it is, you know, we're talking just on the island of Manhattan alone, about 400 million square feet. And I always joke, by the time, you know, it's listed on one of the listing services, it's old information. Who gives a hoot what's listed on CoStar? I need to know stuff before it actually hits the street. And again, part of the beauty of CBRE, which is now the largest commercial real estate firm in the world, but also in this marketplace and totally dominant. I mean, between 4 and 5 of every commercial deal done in this market is done by our firm on one side or the other, or sometimes both. So the amount of knowledge, I often joke, you could stand in the hall of 200 Park and learn more about what's happening in the city than almost any place else you could go in New York.
Coming back to your arts background.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say I'm intrigued, given the fact that you were at the White House, you also taught at Georgetown. What made you go into real estate? It seems like a big shift.
Indeed. So I always say that going into real estate was, first of all, I grew up in a working class family in the Bronx. I didn't even know what commercial real estate was until I was 36 years old. And I have to say, I certainly didn't dream as a young student, I hope someday to be a commercial broker. What actually happened was, when I joined the Carter Mondale administration in the first year they were at the White House, everybody signed a document that said that you would not, for 3 years after you left federal government, you would not work for anyone you gave federal dollars to. After about a year and change of working on the Mondale staff, I was made deputy chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, which gives, at that point, by the way, the Arts Endowment was a much more powerful institution than it is today. Actually, shockingly to think that in the late 70s, we were giving out more money than is being given today by a factor of almost a third more. So I, as it turned out, signed all the grant letters that came out of the endowment. And I remember the first time I was signing them, because it was hard copy, you know, great big files that would come in literally practically by forklift into my office, and I'd sign away on all these letters. I realized, gee, I'm not going to be able to work for any of these people for 3 years after I leave. And I was in, you know, my late 20s at this point, and I was like, you know, this is such a great job. What are you going to do? So what happened is two things that come together. One is, while I was at the Arts Endowment, I got divorced, and I got involved with a guy who was in medical school in D.C. at that time. And then he said to me, where do you want to end up? Because I want to do my internship and residency in the location where we ultimately are going to live. And so I said, I want to go back home to New York. So what happened is, my husband, David Hidalgo is his name, he went up to NYU and began his residency. This is now, by now we're married. I'm living in D.C. with our son. And suddenly I realize it's the end of the Carter Mondale. They didn't get a second term. I have to move to New York. I went and worked in the dawning age of cable television. And I was excited about the fact after almost 4 years of separation, you know, David living in New York and my living in D.C., I was excited that we were going to live together. I get this job working for ABC Video Enterprises. Terrific job, only to my horror, I discover that I am traveling 3 weeks out of every month. So even though we ostensibly have the same home address now, I'm still on the road. And I think to myself, I have a young son, I have a husband who was in surgical training and whose hours were incredibly erratic. One day I'm in Venice, I'm buying Rai television product for A&E, the channel we created, and I meet a retired commercial real estate broker and his wife. Turns out they're going home on the same flight I'm going home on from Venice. We share a Vaporetto to the airport. And I had been buying in lira for 3 days preceding this. This gentleman, retired broker, says, let me pay the Vaporetto driver. And as he does, I observe that the Vaporetto driver is bilking him on the exchange. Only because, again, I've been trading in lira for the preceding few days. So I tap the Vaporetto driver on the shoulder. I say, no, no, no. And I take away whatever the appropriate amount of change was. Retired broker says, you'd be great in my old profession. And all the way home on the plane, he tells me the story of what commercial brokerage is. And as I'm listening to it, the things that jump out at me are, one, it's not a corporate business. So even though I'd be starting in my mid-30s, I wasn't going to have to climb some tedious ladder. Two, it involved negotiation. And three, the winning thing, it involves staying in New York because that's where the product was. To this day, CBRE is really a fast global company, and I have many colleagues who are like traveling all the time. And if somebody says to me, come and do this deal for me in Chicago, I'm like, no. If I were cutting a deal in any place beyond the tri-state region, I would bring on the local expert because I don't care what anybody says. The customs of the country are different. Mm. And I've done work in Shanghai. I've done work in London. I've done work certainly in Hong Kong. And I can tell you that all I can bring is the insight of the company taking the space and how they look at real estate and how they account for it, et cetera. But I'm certainly not telling anybody what a deal looks like in Shanghai and who the players are.
I don't know if you can maybe just tell us a little bit about that oddity of New York. It's so small, so compact, and yet it still has pockets that are ripe for development.
So the thing that is extraordinary about New York is just that. The ability to make something happen still exists here so many years after our founding. Now, the first thing I have to tell you, though, is New Yorkers are people of their neighborhoods. I can tell you that there are people who don't want to ever go above 14th Street in Manhattan. I find it hilarious. By the way, most of those people have moved to Brooklyn by now, I might add.
And
that's
guilty.
Yeah, right. That's a whole conversation unto itself. But people really are wed to their neighborhoods. My husband often jokes when we go to the theater. He'll say to me, he'll show me his outfit in the morning, we're going to go to the theater that night, and he'll say, do I look sufficiently like I come from the Upper West Side? Because if you go to Broadway, the whole theater looks like it just came down from the Upper West. I mean, it's just a funny thing if you can read the tea leaves. And so these established neighborhoods, people in New York cling to those neighborhoods. They're very reluctant to go anywhere. However, if you give people something they haven't had before, and I would think the High Line and Hudson River Park are a perfect example of this, suddenly, all of New York clamors for it at that point, and then they price it to the moon if it's in Manhattan, or for that matter, in Brooklyn. If you begin to reinvent places like Dumbo, that you make real, you know, the parks come alive. Obviously, Brooklyn Heights, all the areas around Prospect Park have always flourished, but then you make a Barclays, and suddenly that whole district becomes a very different equation. So the thing about New York is no one will go there until somebody goes and turns around and says, you know what they've got there? And then the avalanche begins. So the trick is to try and get there before all of that happens.
I don't want to have to paraphrase Donald Trump, but I'm going to. You know, the art of the deal, what is that in brokerage? I mean, what makes a good broker and what makes, more importantly, a good deal? Are there certain elements without giving away too many trade secrets?
I don't actually, you know, I still have my old transparency gene. I don't think there are any secrets. I think the first thing is to be a really good listener. to understand, I think, what people are telling you that their needs are, and then to do something else, which is to intuit what they're not telling you. The next thing is to have ideas. I think people, again, rely too much on what's out there in a listing system. I look at a map more than I look at the listing system because I want to give somebody an idea that doesn't exist. And then I think the third thing, and very important, is if you've got some really good idea, don't sell it to the wrong person. If you have a company and you have something that's a radical idea, you are not selling this idea to the person who's in charge of facilities. They're not interested in a big, bold idea. You have to sell it to somebody who embraces it at the most senior level. So I think those three things are part of the magic of this. In fact, I think those three things are the heart and soul of it. And the beauty of our city is that it allows for many ideas because the city is so hard to develop in. And if you know how to navigate your way around the regulations, you're not getting out of the regulations. But if you know where the decision points are, who has to be influenced, not only at your company, but in the hierarchy of the city, you can do pretty remarkable things.
I mean, you've been credited with transforming or helping transform the Manhattan skyline. And there's a kind of star list of clients that you've worked with, everyone from 21st Century Fox to Condé Nast to the New York Times and on and on. Looking back, is there a particular project that was a highlight for you to work on?
I always say the Times building was the single most difficult transaction. I said it was the PhD program in real estate because, first of all, the deal structure involved everything.
This is the move to 8th Avenue.
The move to 8th Avenue. And I want to say people always say, oh, the move to 8th Avenue was the beginning of the decline of the business. And I want to point out that, in fact, that move not only allowed them in the darkest days after Lehman to borrow against that asset because it was such a killer deal. What was accomplished there is that we made for the Times a place that they can live in forever, so inexpensively, and yet it's so brilliant at the same time. First, they said, you know what, we're not going to do this deal. We're going to renovate our building. And we had given them numbers on what we thought the renovation was going to cost. Now, they'd been in their building since 1913. By the way, one of my favorite things about the Times story is that they genuinely believed it cost them nothing to live in the building because they have no debt on their buildings. The Times is not a company that mortgages its assets. And we showed them that the maintenance of that building, they kept steel workers on staff 24 hours a day, so three shifts of steel workers, 365 days a year, because the electrical closets were built in 1913. The newest one was from 1949, and the parts weren't made anymore, so they needed guys there who could fashion the parts, because the other thing about the Times building is it's never dark. Remember, they're always putting out a newspaper. So that was the first thing. We showed them all the costs that keeping this building that was never meant to do what it's doing going. The second thing that happened is it used to be a factory. That's where they printed the newspaper. And when they moved, suddenly the building got retaxed as an office building. Boom, the cost went up. So what happened is they still didn't believe us, and they went ahead and renovated, I think, two of the newsroom floors. We terminated discussions. About 15, 18 months later, I get a call from Michael Golden, then vice chairman of the Times. And he says, can you and Gregory, my partner Gregory Tosco on this deal, can you and Gregory come over and sit with us? And I sat with he and Arthur Sulzberger, his cousin, who was CEO, is CEO of the Times. And they said the newsroom costs more than we thought it was going to cost, and nobody's happy with it. Let's go reopen discussions. So we ended up doing a ground lease, a 29-year tax deal, a joint venture, a condo structure. I mean, that building is everything, and it is a bonanza for them. So I'm thrilled with that. But can I tell you one moment that was, for me, most powerful? You know, the Whitney moved downtown recently into the Chelsea, really the meatpacking district. And I went down there one day to see some exhibit, and I went out to the western part of the platform of the building. And I turned my head left and I looked down and I could see One World Trade Center, 3 World Trade Center, 4 World Trade Center. Then I looked to Jersey and I saw Waterfront Corporate Center, the first two buildings I anchored. Then I looked up and I saw 4 Times Square and the New York Times building and the Coach building. And all I did was turn my head from left to right and I could see all these buildings that I thought about first. And that was, to me, that only happened the last year, a moment where I thought, wow, this really has been a great career.
How hard has it been, do you think? Well, you're at the pinnacle of your career. How hard has it been in an industry that is traditionally dominated by men?
I think it remains very difficult for women. I try to think about why that is. And I had a woman mentor. I don't think I could ever have gotten from anyone else what I got from Carol, because she helped me to learn not to personalize rejection. She had a great deal of inner confidence, and as a consequence, you know, truly business was business for her. I think I learned from her that when somebody said no to me, 2 things I learned. It wasn't personal, and even if it was personal, so what? And the second thing was, it was no today. It wasn't necessarily like the Times. It was no right then and there, and then subsequent facts changed it around. So I do think perhaps women are more sensitive, maybe. I also think that ours is a business, like really all businesses, of relationships. Again, for me, a great deal of the power that I exert in this market is that I have access to people all over the place. By the way, I'm happy to supply them with thoughts and information, going back to the transparency thing. So I think the idea is forming those relationships. And I have to tell you, I didn't have as many relationships internally as I needed, but I began to form them elsewhere. I have formed them with government officials, with architects. I have a huge network of architects that I've worked with over time. And again, late last week, an architect called me and said, he's working on a project in Brooklyn. He said, I'm thinking of changing it from center core to side core, where the elevators are placed. He said, what do you think about that? And we had a conversation on where the elevators should go in the building. Those kinds of relationships are things that I think men have enjoyed organically. I think that women have had to appreciate that they need to network in that way. You know, they do a ranking of productivity in the different sectors, sales sector, retail sector, et cetera, and they do it worldwide. And a few years back, all 3 categories, the number one producer were women, and they were all New York City women. And that was a moment of enormous pride for me, because I think it is so much easier to come into an organization where you have a model that you can shape yourself around. So our women's network in the New York region is strong. Our U.S. women's network, which I think was one of the earliest ones created, is very strong as well. So CBRE has put a lot of energy into it. What I say to my female colleagues, however, at CBRE, and what we work to do, is to make sure that they don't just make friends in-house. It really is about casting your net wide in the industry.
Now, you've also been quite involved in philanthropy. How important do you think it is for the current generation of New Yorkers who've been successful in business to sort of get involved in that aspect? And I guess I'm asking because of the death of David Rockefeller not so long ago, that kind of made me think about this golden age of people who are very giving that's kind of died off, and whether that's being replaced. And I just wondered what your thoughts on that were.
Well, you know, it's very funny that you should mention it, because one of the things that has died off is that because New York had so many enormous corporations headquartered here, there was a real commitment in the 20th century to corporate philanthropy. And certainly when you look at David Rockefeller and Chase Bank and all that he did, what's happened over time is that, first of all, there are fewer headquarters, still the most in the nation, but fewer than there were in New York. And secondly, I think that there's just more scrutiny on how the money's being spent, and there's just much more pressure. I'm not saying that there isn't still corporate philanthropy. There is, but it isn't, the largesse isn't as sort of pro forma as it was back in the day. So I think what you see in New York is a real commitment to filling that gap by individuals at all different levels. what I say to my colleagues at CBRE is don't get involved in something that your heart is not connected to, because it's a lot easier for you to give money, and you shouldn't be raising money unless you're giving it yourself. But it's a lot easier to do that if you feel that connection. I mean, I was a scholarship child. I got through high school and college on scholarship. Our family could never have afforded to pay the tuition. And we've been giving scholarships to our high school and elementary school. My brother, a husband, my sister-in-law and I, my sister Joan when she was alive as well, we published a sort of Where Are They Now book of the kids that we've given scholarships to. It's a very interesting thing also to watch sort of the change in the city. Our first person who won in the early 80s was Mary Ellen Sullivan, an Irish Catholic girl who's now a partner at a law firm in Atlanta. Again, working class family. Now the names are like Kekeli Katempe from Togo, Africa. You know, the profile of these kids has changed. But of course, she's a star at Johns Hopkins. And these are kids who, they are invariably the first in their families to go to college. And it's a pretty extraordinary thing to see how not just the money, but the validation changes who they are, their perception of themselves.
I'm wondering where you're eyeing next for a commercial deal. What sort of direction do you think you might move in? Obviously, I'm sure you'll still stay in Manhattan, but is somewhere like Brooklyn somewhere you're viewing more and more?
The thing I love about Brooklyn is that, yes, you can do ground-up construction, but there's so much good product that can be repurposed. Actually, I'm working on a particular project in Brooklyn that I'm fascinated with called The Wheeler. And this is a Macy's department store building, which will continue to have Macy's in the base. But the top is going to be completely reinvented. And I mean completely. It will still have the basic bones, but parts of the floors are going to be taken out and sort of glass boxes inserted. It's hard to describe it. You'd have to see it. It's almost like a jigsaw puzzle. But this sort of mashup of industrial, retail, office in a neighborhood that has all this new residential, you know, Brooklyn has opportunity that I think is passing from us in Manhattan, certainly south of 125th Street. You can still do deals that are economically compelling, and you can still transform buildings. All land is worth more as residential in Manhattan than as commercial. And unless the zoning forces commercial use, you're going to see a condo building go up instead. Whereas in Brooklyn, that's not necessarily the case now. So it's not even a frontier anymore. It's a big wave that's about to come to us. And if we got smart and extended some subway lines that go to either Red Hook or Industry City, et cetera, boom, it would be spectacular.
Well, thank you so much, Mary Ann Tai. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Mary Ann Tai on Monocle 24's Big Interview. This episode was produced by Bill Luty and Guy Lutz, researched by Helena Jarit, and edited by Dia Cesar and Cassie Galpin.